Hey everybody, I'm James. I'm an alcoholic. There he is. I was wondering if he was going to make it. My sobriety date is April 16th, 2018. I have a sponsor. I sponsor guys. I have a home group. It's on Friday nights. It's a yawn. It's a men's group. I'm really, really glad to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much every day. Thanks, Isaac, for asking me to do this. I've always had a lot of respect for this group. I've been coming around, hanging around this group way longer than I've been sober. I've known that crazy bastard for like 16, 17 years. So I've always had a lot of respect for this group. Some of my closest friends come to this group weekly. So it's always an honor when people ask you to be a part of something that you care about so much. And give it up for Charlie, dude. He's killing it. Yeah, give it up for Charlie, because I've got a lot of personal gifts. I will get to those shortly, but one of the greatest things that AA has given me is seeing guys come in and like grab a hold of the program and bring this energy, this like positive willingness to the program, to like all of my friends and to me. You know, like seeing somebody grab a hold of AA gives me like a little bit of energy every day, and that dude is like relentlessly positive. It's kind of fucking annoying, but at the same time, it's helpful, you know, and I work with him too, so that's cool. So, you know, I'm from Tampa. I was born and raised south of Gandy. I was born into an actively alcoholic family. My mother and father were both alcoholics. My father really wasn't a part of the picture. They didn't work out too well. And around when I was 8 years old, my mother actually got sober in AA back in 1991. And my life changed drastically for the better as a result. Obviously, my mom could hold a job. You know, she became happy with the person she was. And I grew up around AA. I grew up in the back of meetings, playing on my Sega Game Gear, listening to speakers, you know, basically peering into the future, apparently. My father chose another path. And when I was 14 years old, his alcoholism killed him. He died as a direct result of his drinking. There was no two ways about it. It was a lot of physical complications and things like that. So I had both paths laid out in front of me. And I had a lot of personal connection to alcoholism because it changed my life for the better. And I have very few memories pre my mother's sobriety, but the ones that I do have, they're not good, you know? So I knew what alcoholism looked like. I knew what it could do. And I knew what getting sober looked like and what it could do. And it didn't stop me one fucking bit from trying to be as much of an alcoholic as I possibly could from as early of an age as I possibly could. Something about 100 people staring at me makes me thirsty, so I might be. Attendance is healthy here, by the way. This is good to see. This is nice. Straight out of the gate. I went to Catholic school up until the eighth grade, so they kind of had, you know, a nice firm dome around me, you know, for a while. And as soon as that was taken away, I was completely off the rails. Once I learned that you didn't have to go to class, I completely stopped going to class. And I learned that if you just were, you know, swift enough about it, you could take beer out of gas stations and go drink it behind them and, you know, and get away with it. It didn't matter what time of day it was, you know. All the kids would be meeting at Plant across the street, where they hold a lot of AA meetings now in that Palmacia area. But that hallway used to be where you smoked cigarettes in the morning. And it was like kids were smoking cigarettes and I was drinking beer, you know, 7:30 in the morning. I was always getting it as hard as I could. No real like consideration for consequences or anything like that. And I had negative consequences almost immediately. I had trouble with the law. First time I was handcuffed, I was 15 years old. The juvie, W.T. Edwards, the Jack Center, the Axe Youth Detox that I've since taken meetings to. And they don't listen any more than I did back then, but that's cool because it's not for them. But and it just never was a deterrent. And there's a lot of stuff about my personality that may or may not be connected directly to my alcoholism, right? Like, you know, I like to tell people before I tell my story that your story ain't got to look like mine in order to classify as an alcoholic. What I learned when I got here was there's two things about this disease that maybe AA can help you with, and that's the allergy that I get. When I start drinking, I can't stop. Something else has to stop me. And even in the face of consequences, I will drink no matter what. That I have no defense personally inside of me alone against the first drink, regardless of what I know it's going to do to my life. And those are the only two qualifiers. All the other stuff that you're about to hear about and think maybe some type of way about me afterwards has gotten really no, you know, point as far as relevancy to alcoholism in and of itself. Just it's my experience, so it's what I share. So yeah, I mean, like I said, I was getting in a lot of trouble, couldn't stay in school. My mother kicked me out of the house. You know, she couldn't take it. I went out to California to get off drugs in the 90s, moved to San Francisco, backfired, you know, and came right back and literally got picked up from the airport and taken to the juvenile detox center. Like, my mom was just not having it, you know, and I just pushed back harder, and it really caused like a pretty bad rift in our relationship. And we had a really, you know, rough go of it for a couple of decades there. But, and you know, so I just, you know, wouldn't go to school. I a lot of disregard for the rules, a lot of disregard for the law, a lot of disregard for my health and safety and the health and safety of everyone around me. I would drink and drive constantly. I was totaling car. I've totaled a handful of cars by the time I was 18 years old. I got my first DUI. I was 18 years old, on my 18th birthday, actually. And I was living up in Georgia. As soon as I got my GED, I moved out of the state again on my own and was up in like rural Georgia. And, you know, really got off the leash, you know, and really kind of found my way with alcohol. Before that, it was always like more controlled substances because they weren't as loud, so to speak, as alcohol. You know, you can't hide being drunk. Like, you could hide being lit and tripping and all that. But when I was drunk, everybody fucking knew on the block, you know. And you know, I had to navigate that. But I always wanted to feel different, you know. And I never even, you know, a lot of people I hear, and not to take away from that, you know, they had their nevers, right? That these things that they said they would never do, that they end up eventually doing that. I didn't have that. Like, from the first time I knew that, like, IV drug use was a thing, I wanted to try it. The first time I knew that smoking crack was a thing, I wanted to try it. Like, I was just all about anything that was too much and that would make me feel different than the way I felt when I woke up in the morning. And so I'm up in Georgia, and about 6 months after that first DUI, my first big boy jail encounter, I end up in a blackout in Decatur, Georgia, getting into a physical altercation with a police officer and catching a whole bunch of really bad charges and going to jail. I got sentenced for 5 years and I did 20 months. And I was, you know, a somewhat suburban kid from South Tampa doing like real big boy time in South Georgia. I did not fit in. And I was not tough, and I had to learn how to be tough in like the hardest way possible. And I say that to say that I was the most scary experience of my life up until and really since that point. It was a fucking horrible experience, and it was a direct result of my alcoholism. I was in a blackout from drinking, and I got into a fight with a police officer. There was no way to talk my way out of that was an alcoholic thing that had happened. And yet within 2 weeks of being out of prison, I was drunk again. Like, there was nothing about it that was ever even an idea. Knowing, looking at my disease in the face and knowing what it was doing to my life and how hard and painful it was making my life, and I was still willing to get drunk just to feel different. And it wasn't like 3 or 4 months after I got out that I was back in Atlanta for a whole other mess. I was on the morning news for that one. If you ever got time, you want to sit around and have a cup of coffee, we can talk about that story. But they're going to start to sound redundant after a while, so I'm just going to kind of blaze through them, you know, and that one, you know, the family kind of got behind that one and helped out legally, so I got out a little bit and came home and got all the probation and stuff transferred down to Tampa. This is in 2003, I think, and I went and lived at a place called New Beginnings, and it's still around. It's up in Sulphur Springs, right? So this is right when it was first starting. It was a church that was basically doing like a sober house thing, slash work camp, you know, and all that. And that's where I got introduced to like narcotics. And again, 0 to 100, right? Like, there was no, I was not afraid of hanging around the people that were doing that kind of stuff. I was never holding back. I would go until there was no money left or until the people I was hanging out with didn't want me around anymore, which happened pretty frequently and always confused me because I always thought I was better than they were. But, you know, I would go on these things, and like I said, I knew about AA, and I had had some experience with the program already at this point in my life. I had had some experience. So I would go on these, like, 3 or 4 month stints where I'd stay close. I'd go to meetings, and if you can't tell yet, I'm a pretty good communicator, and so I would talk the part pretty well, and I would make friends, and I would feel pretty genuine about the process off the rip, and I would get that relief that you get when you first come into AA, you know, like, I'm not having to hustle $50, $60, $200 every single day just to keep from, you know, seizuring out. And my life would start to feel pretty good. And you know, I wouldn't follow through. I wouldn't stick around. I wouldn't commit. I wouldn't go to the events, right? I wouldn't become a part of the social circle. I wouldn't, like, give you my actual phone number. And if you called me, like, and if I did happen to, because somebody coaxed me into it, I was not answering when I saw you calling. You know, it was like a strictly in the rooms type thing for me. And so I never stuck around, and it would never hold. And then I would go on these horrendous binges, and I would just throw everything that I had built in 3 or 4 months, whatever job I had gotten, whatever apartment I had found, would all go down the shitter in like a matter of days, you know, because I would just go 0 to 100. And at this point, I met a really great woman, and we got really close, and her family sort of adopted me in a sense. Her dad, you know, I never had a father, and this guy was a pretty prominent character, and he was a farmer, and he had a farm down in Port Tampa, and he sort of took me under his wing. I think he saw an opportunity to, you know, help, like, a guy that he saw some potential in, and he meant a lot. My relationship to him meant a lot to me, and obviously to her as well. We got married, and somehow I was able to sort of skirt the alcoholic issue just enough at times to convince everybody that, because I really did have good intentions. That was the thing, too, is I wasn't lying to people. Like, I wanted to be a good dude, you know what I'm saying? I just couldn't stop getting fucked up, you know? And when I was fucked up, I wasn't me, you know? And I got fucked up all the time. So, like, who really was me, you know? But like, I mean, I meant what I meant, you know, and I still mean it. And you know, so it was this big to-do, too. We get married, and there's, like, fucking 400 people at this wedding. Her dad was, like, he was kind of a big deal, you know. And we went to the West Coast for our honeymoon. We did, like, a month and a half on, like, from San Fran up to Oregon. And, like, within 3 days of being there, I disappeared for 48 hours with our mutual credit card and went on a binge. And so from, like, the moment I had the validation, I was locked into the relationship, I just went down in flames. And, you know, she was a trooper. She stuck it out for, like, another couple of years. Yeah, I wasn't, like, a violent guy or, like, a philander or anything like that, but I was impossible to live with. I was impossible to be in a relationship with. I would take the electric bill money to the bar. Like, I couldn't get to the electric company from the house without going to the bar and spending all that money and whatever else I could get my hands on. You know, it was a mess. And when that relationship dissolved, I really kind of found an excuse to drink myself into an oblivion. And I moved to Savannah, Georgia, and I had a friend living there. And there's a few towns in this country that lend themselves to the alcoholic lifestyle, you know, like New Orleans and some college towns, and Savannah's one of them. And you can walk down the streets of Savannah in a blackout in the middle of the day on a Tuesday, and nobody's going to look at you fucking twice. They're going to help you. They'll help you get into a cab. They'll buy you a fucking beer. Like, they'll watch you stumble into the bar. And I've done it, you know, and bought the guy a beer. Like, you definitely need more in you. And you know, I just made that work for a few years. And I say made it work, but it wasn't working at all. I couldn't pay my rent. And I lived in an old Victorian house that split up like 6 bedrooms. And we all had to come up with $200 every month. And I was bartending, making $500 a night. And I never paid rent once in 4 years. I never made it on time. I was the late fee king. I was always paying the late fees. Sometimes we would tape our rent to the inside of the door so the landlord would just come and get it. And I even snatched that shit up a couple times. Snatched everyone else's rent money up and, you know, hit the streets pretty hard with it. You know, I would get pretty down on myself from time to time, and about this time in my life, I'm in my mid-20s, and I became very physically addicted to alcohol. And if I didn't have alcohol from the moment I'd wake up, I was sick, and I had to drink every single day. And suicide was a pretty regular, you know, consideration for me. I just never had the constitution for it, so to speak. You know, I made a couple of half-ass attempts in the Savannah time, but always, you know, with that little, just a little touch of sense in it so it wouldn't work. One particular time where I pawned everything in my roommate and my house that belonged to us and anyone that happened to leave it here, I made a pretty serious attempt and took a whole lot of barbiturates and just slept it off. I don't know. I, I went number one and two all over myself and was asleep for like 3 days and got up, went, took a shower, and walked downtown and went to work. And like it was fucking nothing, and had to explain why the TV and the Nintendo whatever was gone and all that shit to my roommate. But, you know, that was the thing, is that I got really comfortable being miserable. I'd always kind of been okay with rough circumstances. I don't really need a comfy bed. I didn't need nice clothes or anything like that. You know, all I needed was a pack of smokes and a bottle of whiskey and some loud music or whatever, you know, and I was like good. And so this stuff, you know, it would just become par for the course for me. I knew how to navigate these situations where everything was on fire. After about 4 years of playing that game and basically just sitting on bar stools. So I went to Savannah actually under the, precursor that I was going to go to film school. I've always really loved films. And I actually worked on a few when I lived in California and not porn. Okay. Get your head out of the fucking gutter. You. Goddamn, that was a good one. So I told people, there's this huge school in Savannah called the Savannah College of Art and Design, SCAD, and they got a great prominent film program there, and that's why I was going to Savannah, and I believed it too. Buddy fucking believed it. I lived there for 4 years. I don't know where that fucking film building is. I still don't know. I sat on bar stools and pontificated how I was going to make the fucking great American film and never took one productive step in realizing that dream. I just stayed drunk and hid from myself in the real world for as long as I could. And after a few years of being there, and actually during that time, I came home once and tried to get sober and go to school. And I met Terry. I came to YPG in 2008, and I gave what I thought was going to be a real, you know, step towards sobriety. Didn't turn out at the time to be that, but in hindsight, was actually a really important part of my life. I met a lot of really good people there. And when I did finally surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous, it made it a lot easier to have those connections, you know. Lloyd was my sponsor, actually. Fucking crazy, dude. And, like, this whole history, like, really trips me out from time to time. But my dad's dad, who I'd never known, passes away. And I'm living in Savannah, Georgia, making fuck all of my life. And my dad's dad started a funeral home chain, Curry Funeral Homes, Blount Curry Funeral Homes. They're still around. He got a lot of money. And I got a big old chunk of it, right? So I had a really good reason to come home to Tampa and cash this big check, and I did. And when I got to Tampa to cash this check, I had lost my cell phone. I didn't have keys. I didn't have an ID. I'd lost my wallet like 2 weeks prior. So I actually went downtown here to the lawyer's office and got a check cut to me for $124,000, right? Like a personal check. And I had to fucking get an ID in order to fucking put this check into a bank account. Like, I had this much money, but my life was so fucked, I literally could not spend it. It was fucking insane. Like, I had to borrow money to go to the fucking whatever driver's tax collector's office and get an ID just, you know, to get the money that would be gone in less than a year, by the way. Less than a year later, I was homeless. And I was living at the Amethyst Respite Center in Drew Park. Early in my sobriety, I frequented that place and take meetings there. I haven't been there in a while, but it's a fucking horrible place. It's definitely not somewhere you would think you would be less than a year after casting a check of that size. And I didn't really do much with the money. I just tried to buy my way out of my pain. And I tried to buy everyone's adoration around me. I took some friends to Europe. We went to Spain. We tried to buy all their cocaine. Didn't work. I ran out of money before they ran out of cocaine. So I came home and it was just another lesson. And it's funny, at the beginning of that, if you'd have told me I was going to blow that money and see nothing from it, I told you I was going to kill myself in that moment. And, you know, when it happened, I felt like killing myself, but I didn't have the constitution. So, again, I just had to move forward, and I just made it work, and I just did whatever I had to do. Didn't really consider going back to AA, though. It kind of seemed like if the perfect woman with the perfect family wasn't going to fix me, and that much money couldn't fix me, and I was never going to have anything to do with this God shit, by the way. So, you know, why even try after this? And that started a period of my life here in Tampa where I was basically homeless. And I would go from the Salvation Army up on North Nebraska. And, you know, I'd live there for couple months, maybe. I think I stayed there for like, got to like the yellow tag or whatever it was. And, you know, but I wouldn't do what people would suggest. And I would always, there would always be like this lingering idea that I just couldn't jive with, like that Jesus thing, man. Like, I can get down with everything else you guys are saying, but that shit ruins it for me. And I got better plans, which included me walking down Nebraska with a garbage bag over my shoulder that had everything I owned inside of it. You know, I really didn't have any fucking better. I just wasn't willing to let my ego deflate enough to let somebody save my life, to let somebody help me, you know. And not to mention, I didn't think it was possible. And so I would end up back on the street. And then things would get really fucking bad. And I would end up back in detox. And then I would go to a halfway house. And then I would relapse and get kicked out. And it was like a year or something of this. And I was in a halfway house on 30th Street. Back in the early 2000s, man, they weren't like they are today. And there was no regulation going on. This place was called the Howe House, and I'm going to blast them up real bad because what they were doing was fucking horrible. And it was a two-bedroom apartment, and there was 10 guys living in this fucking thing. And the white work van would show up every morning, and they'd load you out, and they'd send you off to these, like, day labor jobs, and they'd keep your check, and that's how they'd pay the rent, and they'd make you go to meetings, but if you didn't go, it didn't matter, and guys were smoking crack in the rooms, guys were drinking vodka in the bathrooms, and I decided to take my life for real, you know? At least that's what I, you know, I convinced myself was going to do, but before I did, I sent a text to my ex-wife because it needed to be someone else's problem, too, about how I was going to take my own life, and I got my hands on a whole bunch of Xanax, and I took a whole bunch of Xanax. And, you know, enough to take a guy out, I would think. And it just didn't fucking work. And so word gets to her dad that I've made this decision. And he does all this detective fucking work and, like, triangulates my position in town and shows up. And this guy was, like, a fucking force to be reckoned with. Right, this guy would show up in a beat up old pickup truck, and he wasn't 120 pounds soaking wet, but he would do what you asked him or told you to do. It was just something. There's something about this guy's presence, and he got word that last time I was seen, I was walking down 30th towards Fletcher, and he went and he found me, and I was dying in a dumpster, or up against a dumpster behind the CVS. You know, there's a Wawa there now, right there, Fowler, and 30th Street, and he threw me in the back of his pickup truck, and he took me to his farm. And I got sober, and I came back to AA, and Terry was my sponsor this time, and I lived. We built a wooden platform on the ground and put a canvas 12x12 Civil War reenactment tent on it, and I lived in there. I lived on a cot in there, and I woke up when the donkey screamed at me at 4 a.m., and I fed that motherfucker, and I milked some cows, and I took care of chickens. Swear to God, and I went to a noon meeting down the road, and I got my color back, I got my life back, and I got me back, and I became a good, you know, fucking good-looking party dude, man. It was it. I'd found my calling. I was going to be a fucking chicken farmer in Port Tampa, and I went to AA, and I smoked a fat joint every single night before I went to bed, and I didn't fucking tell anybody, and I kept that just to me. That was mine, because I earned that, at least, right? I wasn't doing anybody any harm. I pretended I was doing the steps. I pretended I was being honest with everybody. I really wanted to. I didn't even fucking think I was lying. The mind game I performed on myself to convince myself what I was doing. And it went, it elevated. This confused self-image got pretty fucking intense. So about 11 months of this go by, and I bump into a guy, you know, down in West Shore at that Circle K by the Cove, you know, an old party buddy of mine. And, you know, he's got some pills on him. I never really messed around with those kinds of pills, the opiate kind. And I had no defense against the first drink because I hadn't surrendered my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. I just hadn't done it. I'd go to AA and I'd talk and I'd preach AA and I'd even fucking pick up chips, you know. But I wasn't a part of this program. I did not do the very important part of the third step and that I do every day today. By the way, now I say that prayer every morning, but not right there. But I took some of the guy's pills and I ran that gamut. And we've all heard it a million times. And there's probably a lot of people in this room that are familiar with it. You start taking them, turns into snorting them, turns into shooting them, and then you're shooting dope, and then you're doing whatever the fuck you need to do to get dope every single day. And that all culminated in me stealing a huge pile of money from this guy. this guy that had saved my life. This guy that had saved my life when I was 20 years old when I first met his daughter. You know, this guy that had saved my life when she left me. This guy took me in. And we went and worked on Hurricane Katrina together because he knew what was going to happen to me if I didn't get derailed for a minute, you know. And then he saved my life this last time. And in the middle of the night, I took a big pile of cash from this guy and I disappeared and moved up north. Fuck, I need to get clean. Hold on. Golly, that went by quick. Anyway, so I go up north, and I got a friend living up there. That pile of cash didn't make it to Maryland, bro. I swear to God, I was broke by the time I got to Pennsylvania. And living on the street, and I ended up with this guy, got a job, and through a friend of a friend, this guy's name was Cadillac. He was this big, burly, rockabilly dude that was doing running a carpet crew that would travel around the country and remodel movie theaters. And we really kind of like connected. And I was in the throes of a pretty crippling heroin addiction, but I managed to keep it together on the road with him, you know, just while, because I really respected him. And I, while I was with him, I wouldn't use, you know. And but when he wasn't around, it was like, hey Siri, where can I find dope in Kentucky? You know, and like I would literally use my phone to triangulate like bad drug areas of the town I was in. And I'd just go cop and I'd take all this money I would make, and I was just miserable all the time. And I was really just not trying to stay alive. And he had to break ties with me, you know, reluctantly, but I would become like a sort of a liability. And he left me in Virginia. And I got into breaking into people's houses, you know, because that's what fucking cool 30-year-old dudes do is, you know, kick doors in for dope money. And was horrible at it and got in trouble immediately and went to jail and was Mr. fucking AA in Roanoke County Jail for like a year and got in this program on like in the pod, like a control movement pod. And I held this AA meeting every week and I was like, because I knew AA so well, you know, and I was fucking so preachy. And I got out of there and didn't go to a meeting, completely fucking forgot everything I was saying about and was high in like 3 days. And so this is like the winter time in 2017 in Virginia. And I was just basically living on the street. I'd get like a job waiting tables somehow. I don't even know how I was fucking pulling this shit off, to be honest with you. And like overdosing every other week in the hospital. And I had a really bad overdose that like landed me in the hospital for like a week and a half. I lost my hearing. And I got up out of the hospital bed as soon as I could stand up. And I pulled all my tubes out. And I walked across Roanoke in the middle of the winter. It's fucking cold in Roanoke in the winter. Like way colder than Florida ever gets. And went back to the same bag of dope. You know, the ambulance pulled me out of there. They didn't pull my dope out of there, and I knew it. And I went back to it, and I got right back to it. The same stuff that had just put me in the hospital. And that was, like, the closest brush with death I had ever gotten. Like, I got a lot of really concerned people in my life poking around and blah, blah, blah. And I had been pissing hot at my felony probation the entire time I had been out of jail. So, thankfully, I had warrants, bench warrants out, and I got picked up on one. April 16th, 2018, and that was the last time I ever, so that's the last time I ever did any drugs, that's the last time I ever drank any alcohol, it's also the last time I ever stole anything, it's also the last time I ever, like, knowingly lied about anything important, it's a lot of lasts on that day, because when I got out of jail, and I came home to Tampa, and I joined AA, and I mean I joined AA, I did everything that these people told me to do. And I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was told that getting off the drugs and the drinking was barely scratching the surface of what was going to be asked of me in order to be a productive, contributing member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because remember, I was never lying to anybody. I always wanted to be that guy. Like, I really did. I wanted to be a useful person. And I wanted to be a friend. And I wanted to be a mentor. You know, I wanted to be, like, dependable. And so I just gave up. And I don't know what was different. My life had been in fucking shambles plenty of times up until that point. There was nothing particularly unique about this set of circumstances, right? Homeless, fresh out of jail, no money, nothing but a path of fire behind me. Literally a dozen times that scenario had happened to me. Like, it's literally happened to me all the fucking time. But for whatever reason, I decided to be an AA. And that was the difference for me. And when they told me to hit my knees in the morning, I hit my fucking knees in the morning. When they told me to go live in a halfway house, I went and I fucking lived in a halfway house. When they told me not to get the restaurant job at night because I wouldn't be able to make the meetings where my friends were at, I didn't take the fucking restaurant job at night, even though I had no money. For the first 8 months to a year of sobriety, I rode the fucking bus everywhere. And I had enough money, I would somehow get like a side job or two every week to put $125 in the halfway house safe to keep my bed. I'd keep a pack of 305s in my pocket. And I had a food stamp card that they give you when you get out of jail. Pretty easy to get once you, when, if you've been in jail. Like, so if anybody out there is hungry, it's not that hard. And that was my life. And I would go to a bare minimum of one meeting a day. Bare minimum. And on the good days, I was hitting three. And I was just so fucking stoked to be a part of AA. And they made me like a manager at the halfway house. And I've never been so fucking excited of such a bullshit, meaningless position in my life. But I still, you know, I don't see it that way. You know, it's funny to joke about because it kind of is bullshit, but it meant so much to me and what was happening to me. And if you're new in AA, man, I strongly urge you to just give some faith into this program. And I gave some faith and I got some relief. So I bought back in and I got some more relief. And it still, it fucking works like that today. I give to AA, I dig into AA, I get the relief I was needing without having to find it necessary to take a drink or a drug. I fucking, you know, exhale. After a while, I get back into my bullshit ego and back into my way of living, and then I get back into AA, and it gets better and better and better and better and better, and it gets exponential, just like it used to the other way. You know, I used to start off at the bar with all the normal people, and about 10 p.m., we're all drinking, having fun. About 1 p.m., like, the real party people are, like, still hanging out. And then by 4, I'm out in the parking lot, like, where's the fucking heart at? And there's, like, one maniac with me that lives on the street, wasn't even in the bar with me. Like, it used to snowball that way, and it did the exact opposite with AA, you know? And I met a woman, you know, and it's part of my story. It's technically not recommended in this program, but I am married to a woman who is in recovery, and we both got sober at the same time. It has had its challenges. But, you know, it all happened piece by piece, right? So, like, I started off, you know, in the jail cell, and then I moved, and I was living on my mom's floor, and then I was living in a halfway house, sharing a room with, like, 4 guys, and then I got my own room in the halfway house, right? And then I moved out into a house with a sober guy, where I got my own bathroom, I had my whole side of the house, and then my girlfriend got pregnant, and we got a house, you know? My mommy gave me a house. no, shit. So I moved into her house. And my daughter was born when I was like 2.5 years sober. And there's a couple highlights, you know, that have happened in this, you know? So when your kid's born, they do this thing. They do this skin-to-skin thing. They ask dad if he wants, he can take his shirt off, and they'll give you the baby and put her on your chest. And, you know, it's a moment I'll remember till the day I die. The craziest thing about this, and it's not hyperbole either, and it sounds like it, but it isn't. The first thought that rushed into my head when I held that baby was, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's never left the front of my brain. This program's never left the front of my brain. Every huge moment that's happened to me since I've decided to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thought that's come to my head is, thank God for AA. So Riley shows up, and it's better than I ever could have imagined. And I get to be a dad, which is something I never thought I was going to be able to do. Something I had completely given up on the idea of. And not just a dad, but a fucking, like, sober, hardworking, peaceful, somewhat put together dad. I mean, I'm obviously a little fucking confused about some things, but, you know, so, and then my wife, you know, the challenges and the struggles of, like, being in a relationship and growing together has been this, like, insane learning experience that I never even thought I would want to be a part of, or, like, want to give to or contribute to. And it's been so much joy. 8 months ago, she actually had, gave birth again to 2 babies this time. So, yeah, we got twin boys. I got 3 kids, 6 years in sobriety. Fucking fast track to insanity. You know, we bought a house, you know, I had a pretty good job that I lost like 2 months ago, and I got fired from this job that I was like pretty fucking good at, I thought, but whatever. I called my sponsor from the Uber, from back from the office, because they wouldn't let me take my truck, you know, because it wasn't my truck anymore. But and he told me I had to go back to the office the next day and do a ninth step on my boss and apologize to him for making him fucking fire me. And that's some bullshit. That's some fucking bullshit. But what it did is what I was talking about is it brought AA right into the fucking conversation. Good, bad, or indifferent, my life from now until the end, if I want to not fucking drink again, AA has got to be a part of everything. And it did. I went to my boss, who was in recovery, so he knew what was going on. But I did. I apologized to him for, you know, creating a situation where he felt that it was a necessary move, you know. And I was able to move forward from it, and I was able to thrive, and I was able to do, you know, whatever it is that I'm going to keep moving on. And I'm, what I'm doing right now is I'm fucking enjoying the shit out of. It's a lot of fun. I'm working really hard. Couple things. So I was doing the steps, and I'm doing the ninth step, and over like 2 years, my first 2 years of sobriety, I was sending money to that farmer to pay him back. I stole a big old fat pile of cash from that dude, man. And I needed to make it right. And about 2.5 years, I finally sent the last payment to him. I would always send him these money orders with these notes, you know, just like updates, because I was told by my sponsor to not directly communicate, not to make it uncomfortable for the guy, just to send him the money, and if I wanted to, let him know how I was doing. And so I send a final payment. I get a phone call like a week later, and he's like, come on down to the farm, dude. I can't wait to see you. Because that was like a thing for him. It was a real legit thing, man thing. You pay your fucking dues, and you're back allowed on my property. So I took my wife and my brand new baby daughter and got to meet D. And like 3 months later, he got killed. He got killed by a cow. I fucking kicked him in the chest on his farm. I'm sorry. It's kind of fucking funny if you know the guy. Like 75 years old fighting a fucking bull and got killed, you know. And when he got killed, they asked me to speak at his funeral. And it was one of the most important, engagements of my life. And I fucking killed it too, by the way. It was just cool. I'm just kidding. But... Yeah, it's bad. I know. But so Blue, my ex-wife, comes up to me, and she had gone through his safe when he died, and every single letter I had sent him was in that safe, you know. He had, and she, you know. So I got to make that right. And then a year ago, so Caddy was a sober guy. He wasn't an AA guy, but there's a reading after this meeting you're going to hear about the real true spirit of this program can be boiled down to two words, love and service. And this guy, Caddy, he lived them. He, like, really legit lived more than most people you'll ever know are even capable of doing. He took me in, for fuck's sake. And he had 10 years sober. He was the best man at my wedding. He came down. We got married at sunrise on the beach. Yeah, fucking sunrise, because we're psycho. And a year ago in April, he got killed. He got hit by a drunk driver, and he got killed. And it was, like, fucking devastating. It still is. I was at a job today, and there was writing the word caddy was on this AC unit I was working on. Who even does that? So I sent it to his son. His son's a teenager. So I went to his funeral, and I get to Philly. I get like this Kia rental, you know, or whatever. And, you know, I'm looking out of the rental lot, and there's a Cadillac. The guy's name was like, it was his nickname, but it was Cadillac. He had a huge Cadillac tattoo on him. He's a big dude, and there was this beautiful brand new Cadillac on the lot. And, you know, not for nothing, I've been sober for 5 years. I can fucking afford to rent a nicer car to go pick his son up in, right? So I rent the Cadillac, and I pick Jackson up in this thing. And Jackson's just like, man, this fucking thing's so sweet. He's 16, you know? He's, like, really into cars. And the day of his funeral, we went to the funeral, and me and Jack always been real tight. And he just wanted to hang out with me afterwards, you know? So I took him to a big church in Honeybrook, Pennsylvania, like a little country town in this parking lot, and I gave him the keys to this rental Cadillac, and I was like, fucking dog this shit to death, bro, go. And I got to sit there and watch this kid laugh on the night of his dad's funeral. And all AA, like down to the money that I got in my bank account to be able to make that thing happen, but also like the forethought that AA gives me to think of other people, how important that moment was, that I'm gonna talk about this moment anytime anyone ever asks me to share my story. This story gets shared because that's the kind of stuff, you know? So like the guy I always wanted to be, and this is what's happened to me now. God has literally recovered the man he intended me to be, right? I'm a friend, I'm a decent friend. You know, I talk a lot of shit, but that's okay. I'm a pretty decent dad. I'm a pretty good husband. I provide, you know. I'm a contributing member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never turned down a sponsee once. Anytime anyone's ever asked me to sponsor them, I can't wait to say yes. And it's a fucking miracle. You know, and my bank account is not impressive at all. And I'm pretty sure that's God doing that to make sure that I keep my ass in check, whether I'm okay with it or not. You know, fucking whatever. We'll talk about that one later, I guess. But my favorite saying in AA is that that I can't seek happiness. I can't look for happiness, because if I do as a person, I will always look for it in the wrong places. I will always look for it in relationships. I always look for it in sort of disingenuous material things. That true happiness is a byproduct of living the right kind of life. And that's it. And for me, the right kind of life is being an AA. So thank you.